All right. So thanks for joining me, Corbin. We've been meaning to talk about this for a little while. For anyone who doesn't know, Corbin Haycock is an awesome ED guy who does everything you can imagine in the ED and stuff that no one's ever even imagined yet, I don't think. So thanks for taking some time, Corbin.
Thanks. No problem.
Today we were going to talk about renal failure and point of care ultrasound. So I'm going to take 30 seconds to go through the stuff that we're not even really going to discuss because we take this stuff for granted. So whenever you're dealing with a patient with acute kidney injury, the nice thing about POCUS is that in about 30 seconds, you rule out pre and post renal, and you essentially narrow down the diagnosis to intrinsic renal. You can rule out pre-renal by taking a look at your IVC, your heart, and combining it with your physical exam, get an idea of the perfusion and whether someone's clamped down or more vasodilated. Essentially, in a nutshell, if you have a tiny IVC and low end-systolic volumes, in the absence of peripheral signs of vasodilation or something like that, you are most likely to be on the dry-ish side. If, on the other hand, you don't have that, then you can't likely say that hypovolemia is causing your AKI. And then, of course, we can just slide down to the kidneys, rule out hydronephrosis. If you find hydronephrosis on both sides or either way, you should probably look at the bladder too, make sure you don't have, some outlet obstruction or sometimes just a Foley malfunction. Anything else to add on that part of it, Corbin?
Nope, that's a pretty good description of the pre-renal and post-renal. I guess there's always the venous congestion side of things too that you can also see.
Sure. And we will definitely talk about that a little bit. But yeah, that's about it. And the nice thing about that, which to me, it's hard to believe that not everyone dealing with any form of AKI hasn't jumped on this. This is really a pretty low-hanging fruit. I'm sure you've seen, or in the past at least, people are requesting an abdominal ultrasound to rule out post-renal, which gets done anywhere from hours to even a day later. And that just to me seems pretty ridiculous. Everyone should be able to do this. It's pretty basic. It would take about 15 minutes to learn.
Yeah, and it's really not hard. Yeah.
There you go. But we've got a spicier topic to talk about today, which is, can you look at intrarenal Doppler hemodynamics to choose your vasopressor choice in a patient with sepsis and oliguria or anuria or overt AKI? We've been playing with this and discussing it for the last couple of years, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. 2018 or something like that.
Right. And trying to figure out what we can do with this. So let's go over it. It was definitely Corbin who first introduced me to the idea. So go ahead, tell me what you've been doing.
Should we talk about the renal resistive index or the, do you want to quickly do the VEXAS stuff?
Yeah, I mean, quickly do the VEXAS stuff, I think, and then we can.
Yeah. So a big cause part of what dings the kidneys is venous congestion rather than poor perfusion coming from the arterial side. And we can see it pretty easily once you look at it. You see a dilated IVC, and then you can quickly do some Doppler on the hepatic vein, portal vein, and the intrarenal venous vein. And intrarenal veins. And if you have of those three areas, once you have a dilated IVC, if you have at least two out of three severe congestive signs on the Doppler pattern, then that's a pretty good indicator that you're going to wind up with a kidney injury, even if you can't see it on the labs yet, the creatinine or whatever. So there's other, I guess, posts on VEXAS and stuff where people can look into that. And we've gone over it, and it's actually really interesting. I think what you wanted to mainly talk about is the intrarenal arterial flow patterns. and probably specifically in the setting of sepsis and septic shock.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, so I guess maybe we should start with what's the renal resistive index and what it means and where it comes from. If you put the ultrasound over the flank and you do a pulse wave Doppler on one of the intrarenal vessels, the interlobar vessels or an arcuate vessel, you'll get this Doppler signal that above the baseline is the arterial flow and below the baseline is the venous flow. And it above the arterial flow is this pulsatile sort of thing with both a systolic and a diastolic component. And the better the flow through the kidney, the less the difference is between the peak systolic velocity and the end diastolic velocity. And there is this thing called the renal resistive index where you just basically take the difference between those two velocities and then divide them by the peak systolic velocity. And you'll get a ratio there that basically is a healthy flow is 0.6 and something's wrong if you see something above 0.7. The venous signal is pretty straightforward. It's just kind of like, is there congestion or is there not congestion? But the arterial flow pattern is actually kind of a bit complicated. What generates the systolic component of the flow pattern is mainly systemic hemodynamics. And so that can be a high pulse pressure, high flow out of the left ventricular outflow tract, and large arteries and, you know, an aortic vascular compliance being low. And so that's those things are going to give you a higher peak systolic velocity. The diastolic part of the renal resistive index tracing there is going to be mainly intrarenal or micro hemodynamic flow patterns. And it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it a renal resistive index. It's really a renal impedance index, impedance to flow. The things that determine that is going to be the one systemic thing is the heart rate. The faster the heart rate, the more diastolic flow you're going to have because there's less chance for runoff. But there's the renal capillary wedge pressure, which is kind of a lumped value of interstitial renal capsular edema, so like renal sarca or a wet swollen kidney. The venous pressures and the actual back pressure from like the ureters. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the actual resistance to flow by kind of, you know, all those arterial factors that determine resistance and other things too, you know, so like viscosity and the vessel diameter and the length of the tubes and all that kind of stuff. Just kind of putting it down to like clinical stuff, peak systolic velocities are going to be affected by heart failure, aortic stenosis, coarctation, aortic sclerosis, renal artery stenosis, sepsis can do it because of the, you know, the hemodynamic changes just with the, you know, like a pounding heart and all that, hypovolemia. And the diastolic component is going to be affected by, you know, heart rate, arterial sclerosis, like chronic kidney disease, you know, like stiff vessels in the kidney. Obstructive uropathy will give you a high renal resistive index. Hypoxia and hypercapnia do it. Hemorrhage, drugs. And so that's kind of the determinants. As you can see, it's a little bit complicated what's going on. Clinically, what's really important is to us is what's the actual diastolic flow, and the better diastolic flow we have, the better the kidneys are going to do. Mm-hmm.
So, if I'm just going to look at it from a simple standpoint, and the way that I'd always sort of when you first started to talk about it, it had struck me how useful it could be is that, because to me, there's always been that uncoupling between pressure and perfusion when you're using, you know, increasing doses of vasopressors, right?
Right.
And, you know, that's one of the reasons I always sometimes like to use tissue oximetry to sort of sometimes say, diagnose, if you will, that uncoupling and realize that, you know, I need to do something about the output rather than, you know, keep working on the SVR.
Right.
And this would be an actual sort of hemodynamic marker of like, uh-oh, as I'm ramping up, if I'm seeing, you know, my renal resistive index go up, you know, due to, with my end diastolic velocities drop down, then I should be concerned that, you know, my jacking up of the vasopressors, your levofed or norepinephrine, is, you know, improving my central pressure, so to speak, but my organ, you know, perfusion is worsening, specifically at the renal level.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. Perfect. So you're going to have different flow through the regional vascular beds that's all going to contribute to your sort of global hemodynamic pattern. So I should probably, before you just say right from the get-go, my approach is first to fix the macro hemodynamics. You know, optimize my cardiac output, my systemic vascular resistance, and try and keep the right atrial pressures low. And of course, you have to, you know, look at the
wait a minute. Did you just say keep the right atrial pressures low? Doesn't that fly against everything we've ever heard of and learned about giving fluids to renal failure and sepsis?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the lower the right atrial pressures are, the better your right ventricle is working, and the better it's pushing stuff forward. Now, if you have if you have tachycardia and a low left ventricular stroke volume with a low right atrial pressure, well, okay, that's a person who needs some fluid. But in general, you know, if you have adequate cardiac output and an adequate systemic vascular resistance, the perfusion is going to be better if the right atrial pressures are lower. And it's just a sign that things are kind of going well as far as a right ventricular performance.
Yeah, I think the nicest sort of almost pragmatic paper on that, which I really like, is this big I think it's actually a nephrology-based study that showed that, you know, I think it's the association of renal failure with any kind of cardiovascular illness or whatnot. And it's somewhere around 6 to 8 of CVP that turns the curve up, and then that your renal dysfunction tends to happen more, which is pretty low considering everyone wants to give fluids and bolus up and resuscitate up, you know, generally above that.
Yeah, ever since the Rivers trial, you know, it was like everyone was doing the 8 to 12 right atrial pressure thing. And to me, I think 8 is kind of like a high end where you want it below that, you know. So, yeah. So, you know, that being said, I mean, you really have to kind of look at the whole kind of picture. I personally do a pretty complete echo and see where the problem is. Sometimes it's the right ventricular side and pulmonary circulation. Sometimes it's the left. Sometimes it's a vascular vasodilatory systemic problem. But the first step before you do anything is to optimize where your blood pressure is coming on a systemic level.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of got me into this was just noticing as I followed my patients that I was, you know, admitting to the hospital that looked kind of sick is, you know, and this was back when we were maybe a little bit more fluid aggressive, is that the first organ that always got dinged was the kidneys. And I was always taught that the kidneys love fluids, give them all the fluids you can, they'll pee it out and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, like on day 2 or 3, the creatinine's like tripled, you know, on these septic shock patients. And so there's a lot of data out there that says if your kidneys are not doing well in septic shock, your mortality is going to go up. So, what I try and do after I have kind of the macro circulation sort of dialed in is then I go and I have a look and see what the kidneys are up to. And so you were talking about the point of what, you know, what is going on down in the various organ levels. And sometimes maybe the blood pressure may be great, but there's no flow through the kidneys. or, you know, the gut or whatever. And so that's where the renal resistive index comes in. And so we can see how the kidneys are being perfused. There's a number of papers, you know, it's just so I'm not really making this up, but, you know, trauma, higher renal resistive index predicts hemorrhagic shock before it happens. Specifically in sepsis, a high renal resistive index will predict kidney injury before it happens by, you know, a couple of days. There's a paper out there that looked at in septic patients, you know, a whole bunch of factors. And of all the factors, the two things that were most predictive, and they're extremely predictive in, when you combine the two together, was the renal resistive index and the central venous pressure. So a low renal resistive index compared with a low CVP was the best protective indicator of not developing acute injury in sepsis. People have been doing studies with renal resistive index in the case of adding norepinephrine to titrate. And what you get is if you start with an abnormally high renal resistive index and a MAP of like say 65, which is kind of the traditional target, and you titrate in some norepinephrine and maybe push the blood pressure up to like 75 millimeters mercury MAP, the renal resistive index often will improve. And then if you push it even further with a higher dose of norepinephrine, then actually get a rise then in the renal resistive index. So you get this kind of U-shaped curve of optimal flow through the kidney, depending on what the blood pressure is. So there's a sweet spot there. And there's also numerous studies that show that if you start with a bad renal resistive index and fix it, and it's reversible, then you have less kidney injury.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of stuff out there about using the renal resistive index to dial in the flow through the kidneys. Now, most of these studies are involving norepinephrine as the vasopressor. And there's been some stuff out there talking about maybe norepinephrine, it's good, but there's something better, which would be vasopressin. And the theory on that, it kind of goes into some sort of minutia about what drives the GFR in the kidneys. Primarily, the other than tubular or interstitial, like, you know, chloride levels at the macular densa, with tubular glomerular feedback mechanisms. The other thing that affects that is norepinephrine, angiotensin II, and vasopressin. So you think about the afferent arterial going into the glomerulus and the efferent arterial going out of the glomerulus. And norepinephrine is primarily a afferent vasoconstrictor. So if you're thinking about the pressure differential generated by resistance across these little, you know, arterial resistors, if you have a lot of flow going through the afferent and a constriction on the efferent, you're going to have a higher GFR driving pressure and your GFR should go up. And if the afferent constricts and the efferent is less constricted, you're going to have lower GFR.
Right.
But if either of them constrict, the renal blood flow is going to be less because the cumulative resistance through the kidney itself is going to be higher, right?
Right.
So probably with these norepinephrine studies, what's happening is you're maybe increasing the blood pressure and making the perfusion to the kidney better. But then at some point you get too much afferent arterial constriction and the GFR goes down.
Yep.
Okay. So the angiotensin is both a afferent and efferent constrictor. However, because the efferent vessel is about a third of the diameter of the afferent vessel, you tend to get more efferent constriction than afferent, so the GFR will go up. Norepinephrine induces angiotensin secretion, so that some of that pure afferent norepinephrine constriction actually is mitigated by the angiotensin. So depending on a number of factors, you could, with angiotensin, have more or less GFR. There's other things involved, like prostaglandin synthesis, and that's why NSAIDs cause kidney injuries, because that afferent constriction is mitigated by the prostaglandins. Also, angiotensin sensitizes the afferent vessel to glomerulotubular feedback by the chloride levels that come by the macula densa. So if you have hyperchloremia for some reason, an angiotensin 2 around, that you're going to have a drop in your GFR in that case. Okay. So the nice thing about vasopressin is that it is a pure efferent arterial constrictor. And so while it does decrease the blood flow because the resistance through the whole kidney goes down, that the trade-off is you get pure increase in the GFR.
Right.
And so in sepsis, there has been a number of trials looking at vasopressin in addition to norepinephrine as the primary vasopressor, and looking at kidney outcomes. And so I think there's like 5 or 6 studies out there that have looked into that.
Yeah, and if I remember right, the general signal is that you have a little bit less renal dysfunction, whether it may be just paper renal dysfunction, a little bit less need for renal replacement therapy, but it hadn't touched, at least in those you know, groups of patients, it hadn't touched mortality.
And there was one study. I think it was the wasn't Vanish. It was the one just before that. The
Vast.
Vast, yeah. The Vast study, the overall mortality, there was a trend towards a decrease in mortality, but if you looked at the people on low dose norepinephrine, there was a significant decrease in mortality and no decrease if the norepinephrine levels were very high. So at least if your distributive shock isn't too bad, giving vasopressin seems to decrease mortality. The Vanish trial showed that it was kind of funny because they'd used the AKIN classification, and it's kind of like a lumped thing of, you know, creatinine and urine output, whatever. And so the thing was is that the people who got vasopressin didn't have a statistically different change in the, you know, all the variables together, but they had less dialysis, they had less rise in the GFR, all that kind of stuff. Multiple other studies have shown that norepinephrine versus vasopressin, creatinine clearance is higher in the vasopressin, urine output is higher in vasopressin. And so of all the studies out there, there's this hint that vasopressin just is good for the kidneys.
Yeah, I agree.
So what I've been kind of messing around with here for a while is kind of getting once the macro hemodynamics are good, looking and seeing if I can titrate the norepinephrine up to a certain level where I've optimized that U-shaped curve, that sweet spot there, where my blood pressure is pushing blood to the kidneys. And then after that, see if I can make the kidneys work better by giving a little bit of vasopressin as well. The idea there is that if the patients do better with a lower renal resistive index, it doesn't matter how you get them there, but just use every tool you have in your toolkit to drop that renal resistive index.
That makes sense. I mean, you've had that, you know, that New England study there a few years ago on the MAP target in, you know, sepsis, and then especially the patients who had hypertension and all that, you know, benefited from a higher MAP. So right away, if you're getting those macros to a certain degree, and then you're essentially trying to plot out that curve first using norepinephrine, and then once you feel that you've maxed out, you're going to see if you can improve your intrarenal hemodynamics by changing over to vasopressin or adding some vasopressin.
Yeah, what you're really doing is, like, the problem with, like, all this evidence-based medicine is that it's treating every patient as if they're the group.
Exactly.
And by doing this, what you're doing is you're teasing out what the optimal blood pressure is for your patient that's sitting there in front of you.
Exactly.
You know? So, you know, you get these various things, oh, the MAP should be 65, the MAP should be 75. Well, if they're hypertensive, then aim for higher MAP or this or that. It's like, well, what does my patient need? I can see what my patient needs with by Dopplering the kidneys.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is hitting the nail on the head about the RCTs is exactly what it says. Is that it's almost like the RCTs should help you develop your hypothesis for your patient, and then you test it physiologically at the bedside. Because yeah. As far as I'm concerned, a lot of those things, you know, where you're trying to, you know, average out, you know, a bell curve, is really going to tell you maybe, you know, what should your settings be on your monitors, you know, because, mm-hmm. Or how much, you know, that's what I always think. It's really good for planning and stocking and knowing which medications you need more of or something like that. But for your individual patient, I think it's at best, you know, helps you have hypotheses and working theories that you then test out at the bedside and generate some medicine-based evidence, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, you've optimized your macro hemodynamics, and then you look at your Doppler. So now let's say that, you know, you can't bring down your end diastolic velocities anymore. Your RRI is like, you know, the lowest you can get it is maybe 0.75. Then you add in some vasopressin and you try to titrate down. What do you do from there?
Yep. So I Doppler the kidneys. I see where I'm at. If my renal resistive index is more than 0.7, I'll tweak up the norepinephrine, give it about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, come back, Doppler, see if it got better. If it got better, great. Tweak it up just a little bit more. If it didn't get better, or if it gets you know, worse, you know, if it gets worse, you know, back off, go back to where you were, but before you raised it. But if it, you know, if it doesn't budge, or, you know, certainly if it doesn't get better, then that's when I'm going to put on the vasopressin. And same thing, you start the vasopressin, you wait about 10 to 15 minutes and see where you're at. I usually start at, you know, kind of the higher end of the dose, 0.04. But I'll go up to 0.06 and everything, as long as I don't ding my cardiac output that bad by raising the systemic vascular resistance. And another beautiful thing about the vasopressin is that it's a pure systemic vasoconstrictor, and it does not constrict the pulmonary vasculature. So you're not going to ding your right ventricle, raise your right atrial pressures. None of that kind of thing's going to happen to any significant degree with vasopressin.
That's awesome. So I've been doing similar to that on the odd cases that I catch on really early, sort of, you know, as almost in the ED or fresh from the ED. But I've been lazy and lax and haven't, you know, really collected much data, but I'm going to start doing so now. Can you give us a couple concrete cases that you've had?
Yeah, I've been following some of these cases, and writing down stuff and keeping track for a while now. And I think I have more cases, but you and I have been talking about it, and I and the ones I could find, it was kind of a busy shift, so I don't think I found them all.
Just give us one. Just run us through one.
Oh, so you know, I have a case where the guy comes in. He was pretty tachycardic. His renal resistive index was like, I think it was 0.78 or something like that. I put him on norepinephrine, and his heart rate came down. His cardiac output when he started was something like 8 or 9 liters per minute. His SVR was like in the 500 range. Once I started him on the norepinephrine, his heart rate came down. His blood pressure came up, cardiac output dropped a little bit, but it dropped to like 6 or 7 with the increase in the systemic vascular resistance to around 900. And the renal resistive index really didn't change much. So at that point, I put him on some vasopressin. The cardiac output did drop just a little bit more, maybe to 5.5 liters or something. Systemic vascular resistance went up to, 1,000, 1,100. But the renal resistance index dropped down to, 0.63 or something like that. Yeah. And so he just started making urine like crazy. And before he wasn't peeing for about an hour. So, this, about 15 minutes after that vasopressin went on, the urine output goes up. And I think his creatinine was, I don't know what the rest of the world uses, but ours was 3, which is, like 3 times normal.
Right.
And was it at somewhere like 250 or 300 with you guys, I don't know. But within the next couple of days, his creatinine dropped to like, 0.7 or something like that. So, he recovered from his kidney injury, and that goes along with the renal resistive index dropping once the vasopressin went on. And I think that the urine output pickup is also good evidence that this just isn't kind of a first this then that sort of thing.
Sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay. Well, and we've already decided we're going to try to line up a few of these patients and do a little case series. I think it's really worth getting out there, and then hopefully some big groups with lots of flow. And I think we've got a few nephrocritical care guys out there whom this might interest, and hopefully someone hooks on this. Kind of like lots of people have hooked on doing VEXAS. There's a whole bunch of even some VEXAS case reports that have popped up, which is pretty funny. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. Any last little pearls on this particular use? I mean, this, and for those who haven't done it yet, compared to portal vein, hepatic vein, and this isn't that easy. So you got to put in your scans. You got to get in your scan time. You basically need to catch at least one full nice complex. And I think, I don't know if you'll agree, Corbin, but I think the biggest challenge is being able to confidently say, yes, I know that tracing that I've just generated up there is a good one, because otherwise you can make lots of little mistakes along there.
Yeah, just kind of pointers on how to get a good tracing. It's of all the things that we're Dopplering and, of all the visceral organs and stuff, one of the more challenging ones is the kidney, just because the vessels are so tiny. Put your color box over the kidney, and again, you want to Doppler the intralobar vessels, and put your gain up until you start to get a little bit of artifact on your color Doppler gain, and then back off. And then on your color Doppler, if you go and decrease the scale, some of those vessels will all of a sudden pop into view that you can see. And then you'll know where to drop your pulse wave Doppler gate. And then when you activate the pulse wave Doppler, if you're not getting, if your signal is very squashed down, again, just decrease the scale on the pulse wave Doppler. And that will make it wider and make it more easy to get a more precise measurement of what the peak systolic and the end diastolic velocities are.
Yeah. I'll put up a few images and a couple of links. To for people who want to dig into a little bit more, but thanks a lot. I think there's something here, and then soon enough, I think we'll start actually looking at the morphology of the tracing. And I know you remember Sharad from last year's H&R, who's looking at applying some AI onto the arterial side of the tracing. And I think there's interesting stuff that's going to be looked at in there. But thanks a lot for taking the time to talk about this. I'm pretty psyched about it. I'm going to start to try to be a little bit more religious about doing it and looking at outputs and RIs post vasopressin starting. Good stuff.
Yep.
There you go.